First, with France's Bastille Day as a model, President Trump is planning a grand military parade in Washington, D.C. with soldiers and tanks. The idea goes rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue.
If a military parade were to happen, it would be the first in the United States since the 1991 parade celebrating the end of the Gulf War.
Peter Fever is with us now. He's a professor of political science and public policy at Duke University and an expert in civil-military relations. Peter, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
We don't have a lot of detail on what this parade might be or when it would happen, but it is apparently maybe in the works. First of all, basically, what do you make of this concept?
Well, Americans love their military, and the military plays this symbolic role in our society of being the touchstone when we're looking to come together and transcend barriers and transcend divisions. And we use it at moments of high civic religion, like the Super Bowl and sporting events and things like that. We use military symbols, military honor guards. Medal of Honor recipients were the ones who flipped the coin at the Super Bowl, and there was a flyover of the Air Force jets. And so this is a common thing. So on the one hand, it's understandable that the president is reaching for this as something that should, he's arguing, appeal to all Americans. On the other hand, it's not typical that we do a military parade with lots of the hardware. So we usually honor the troops. Veterans will march or active duty will march, but not with the tanks, not with the artillery, not with the heavy pieces that are more customary in other cultures. And so I think that it's that dimension, of course, that the president's most interested in, and that's the dimension that is setting some of his critics' teeth on edge.
And that's a model that a wide range of countries do it, from places like France, as we mentioned, but also, and the president's critics have been pointing toward this, places like North Korea, Russia, the Soviet Union back in the day. Do you worry if that's the model and the hardware is rolling down the street, the tanks and the artillery and the warplanes flying over, does that take us into some weird territory?
Well, first of all, I think a lot of Americans will enjoy the spectacle. Including the president's base. I think it'll go over very well with him. And I think a lot of other Americans who are maybe not politically engaged will just find it interesting to see military hardware presented in that way. At the same time, the comparisons to North Korea and other unsavory states will be inescapable. And for anyone who misses it, I'm quite sure cable TV will do some side viewings to draw the comparison more sharply for the viewers. And so I do think it's the kind of thing that can be easily overdone. It can easily come off as cheesy or worse, and can backfire. Maybe not with the president's base, but with folks in the middle. And, of course, his critics will hate it, will hate every moment of it. Even if they are strongly supportive of the military, they'll hate the perceived politicization of the military for this purpose.
I want to give a listen to Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders talking yesterday about the idea of a parade.
Nothing has been decided or locked in stone. This is in the early discussion phases, and it's something the president is looking at, not just a way that he can, but that the entire country can come together and show support and honor our military.
This is a fine line for politicians all the time, isn't it? Where is the line between publicly honoring the military and a politician using the military as a prop?
Well, every politician has fallen victim to the temptation to, not every politician, but every president has fallen victim to the temptation to use the military as a prop. Sometimes they're derisively called by the military themselves wallpaper. They're put up behind the president, not any president, not just the current president, while the president makes a policy announcement. And they're back there in the visual, and we know they won't boo. We know they won't misbehave. It will be a respectful hearing, and it can be assembled at the last minute and easily controlled for security reasons. And so from a advanced point of view, from a just a media management point of view, they're a favorite audience for presidents. But for precisely that reason, they end up getting used for times when it would not be appropriate, when it's not really a military or national security question, but more of a political issue that's being discussed. And when you do that, you're chipping away at the image of the military as nonpartisan, above politics, so willing to serve whoever is president, and sworn to uphold the Constitution, and thus respecting the office of the president and not the person of the president. Their loyalty is not to the person of the president, it's to the office of the president. And these are fine lines to be worried about. And of course, in this, what makes this particular proposal so difficult is there doesn't appear to be a thing that's triggering it. There's not a recent victory that's triggering it. So the last time we had something like this was in Desert Storm. Well, that was a great victory, at least at the time it looked like a great victory. And it was also a moment to celebrate the end of the Cold War, which was another great victory. And so that parade, it seemed, even though it was controversial and some people think it was a mistake, nevertheless, there at least was a logic to it. The question is, what would we be celebrating now? What's the moment to be remembering it? And the White House, I think, has not yet fixed upon what that would be. And until they do, it's going to look more odd than they intend it to look.
Peter Feaver is with us from Duke University. We're looking at the president's call for a military parade with lots of military hardware. Let's go to your calls now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. You know, if looking at the character of this president and his nature, I think this is really all about him. And as always, he kind of controls the narrative, so he's making it about patriotism, and so if you oppose this, somehow you're anti-military. We honor the military in every small town in America on Memorial Day and Veterans Day and the 4th of July with color guards and things like that, and I think this money could be better spent taking care of the veterans, their health care. You know, the suicide rate of veterans is deplorable, and spend the money on that. But this is all about Donald Trump's ego. He wants to be like the other leaders in the world with these big military parades, and it's against the traditions of the United States too. Everyone knows that we have the most powerful military in the world. We don't need to parade it down our streets like the Russians do or the North Koreans do.
Willem, thanks for the call. Peter, what do you think?
Well, the caller raises an important sticking point, which is the cost. If it's just marching the band and some soldiers, well, it won't cost a lot of money. It's easy to put together. But that's not what the president seems to have in mind. What he has in mind is something much grander. That could be very expensive. And at that point, he needs congressional authorization to spend that money, and the opportunity cost, as the caller suggested, becomes rather pointed. Why spend the money here when the military have a whole lot of other priorities, readiness priorities, new weapon systems priorities, and when veterans have their own health care priorities that could use more funding? And so there is that question of why spend the money here when it could be better spent elsewhere. And I think the White House is going to have to return to that question in order to persuade Congress to authorize the funding for it.
Talk about the idea of a military parade in the nation's capital with Peter Feaver from Duke University.
And you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea? Should we have a U.S. military parade? Do you have any suggestions for other ways the U.S. could show support for the military and for veterans and active service members? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation. Maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. Back to your calls. Kent is on the line in Reedstown. Kent, hi.
Yeah, hi. I think, you know, we almost worship the military. You know, they should be respected, It's our leaders that just trump it up. And speaking of Trump, I mean, you know, these people just want to use the military at the drop of a hat without knowing what they're doing. And we need to think about the military expense. We spend way too much money on it.
Kent, thanks for the call. A lot there, Peter. Respect, he says, but don't blur into worshiping the military.
I do worry about that. I have a lot of respect for the military. I served in the military myself. But I do think that we miss an opportunity to give due deference to other forms of service, not just military service. And there's this idea of thank you for your service, where we thank the military for their service. And I think that's right and appropriate to do. But I would like to see that extended to first responders, to people who work in emergency care, people who help care for elderly in hospices, people who are working with special needs children, things like that, which are very tough jobs that society needs done. We should be thanking them for their service as well. Obviously, what the military does, they risk their lives. It's noble, and it deserves society's thanks, and I'm glad we're doing it. But they're not the only jobs that deserve it. And I do share a little bit of the caller's concern that as a society, we've gotten comfortable thanking only one of the groups that needs to be thanked when there's many others that need the recognition or deserve the recognition.
Thanks for your call. Go next to Gene in Fond du Lac. Gene, hi.
Yes, sir.
What did you want to tell us about, Gene?
I'm a retired Marine Corps officer, and Marines really aren't keen on marching in parades to begin with. We consider them just dog and pony shows, unless you're honoring or rendering honors to someone as part of their ceremony, be it a retirement or a medal ceremony or something like that. But just the logistics of moving that amount of equipment into place to do something like that is just, it will be very expensive. And something to point out, I mean, Anwar Sadat was killed during a military parade review. You know, so it's always been adverse to have that type of thing happen in the U.S. military. We don't do it that way.
Gene, thanks for the call. Peter, people in the military aren't necessarily big fans of participating in these things, Gene says.
Well, you have to ask, where did the leak come from for this story? You know, you heard in your, at the top of the segment, you quoted the White House press spokesperson, and she said, well, it's still in the early stages. Well, I'm quite confident the White House did not leak this story. It's premature for them to see it discussed in public. So you want to know, well, who leaked it? Maybe it was somebody who thought it was a bad idea. And maybe that was someone in the military who had been asked to start doing the planning. I do think if the president wants it and he's determined to have it, and we know he does want it and is determined to have it, he's wanted to have it since the inauguration. At the end of the day, it's hard to say no to the president on something like this. Lives won't be put at risk. There'll be money spent, but it's not going to risk lives, and so it's the president's likely to get it. So then the question is, under what conditions would it be the most appropriate? And I think if we're going to do it, let's do it on November 11th, 2018, on the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, and use it to mark America's century of being a global leader. And the military played a major role in that, not just World War I, but World War II and subsequent wars. There's a way of giving it symbolic meaning so it won't feel quite so out of phase, so odd. And I suspect that they'll settle on something like that that would make it a little bit more sensible.
Peter, end of World War I, end of World War II, a clear victory, a clear moment to celebrate wars. Vietnam, Korea for that matter, Afghanistan, Iraq, they keep going. There's not a clear we won moment. Is it hard to say when we celebrate, to when we have this big ceremony?
Well, I think that's exactly why President H.W. Bush had a big parade at the end of Desert Storm. He was making up for the fact that there were no such parades at the end of Vietnam. And that the military may have received blame for fighting in a war that they didn't pick, that the that political leaders picked, and somehow American people blamed the military for it. And so I think the parade in 1991 was partly to atone maybe for the way the military was treated after Vietnam. But you're right. The current wars that we're in are still, they don't have a clean ending. They don't have a Battleship Missouri moment where it's clearly over. And that's why doing a parade is hard to peg to something. That's in fact why I suggested the 100th anniversary of World War I's ending, because that at least is a clean, obvious landmark to identify.
Peter, very briefly, is this conversation in some ways a distraction from the needs of the military you're talking about, the decisions we have, upgrading the nuclear arsenal that the president is talking about? Should we be talking about those things more than this idea of a parade?
Absolutely. In terms of American military, the much bigger news is not the parade. It's the fact that Senate passed a funding bill that would give them 2 years of predictable funding at levels that are closer to what they need. And that's a much bigger story, much better news for the American military than anything, any parade.
We'll leave it there, Peter. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Peter Feaver. He's a professor of political science and public policy at Duke University. He joined us for a look at plans for a military parade in the nation's capital. You can keep weighing in on this, by the way. Share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
The USA's Olympic curling team this year is dominated by upper Midwesterners. Most of them come from the Duluth Curling Club, and one athlete is based in St. Paul. There are also three competitors from the Madison Curling Club. As Maureen McCollum reports, it's a place with a long history of cultivating Olympic qualifiers.
Nina Roth works as a full-time nurse in the Madison area, but she's had her hours cut way back for a good reason. She's leading Team USA in women's curling, a sport she took up when she was 10.
Took 20 years, but that's normal in curling, and I'm just ecstatic.
In curling, players take turns lunging down a sheet of ice while pushing a rock that's about 40 pounds. They sweep the ice with a special broom to help glide the rock to a target, known as the house. The team that has rocks closest to the center of the house gets the points. It's similar to shuffleboard or even bocce ball. Roth is the skip on the women's Olympic team, which is kind of like the captain. Curling may look like a zen sport, but at the U.S. Olympic team trials on NBC, you can hear Roth and her teammates yelling their strategy at one another.
Yep. All the way. Hard.
Yep.
Hurry.
Oh.
Hard. Gotta go. Atta girl. Roll that up.
We are placing the broom so that our teammates have something to aim at. We are calling the strategy. So depending on where the other team is placing their rocks, we are making offensive or defensive moves based on that. And it's a big responsibility, but it's great.
Roth practices throwing rocks one afternoon at the Madison Curling Club. This place is like her second home.
Growing up in Madison, we have a lot of Olympic curlers who have come through this club. So I grew up playing with a bunch of them and admiring them. And some of them were actually my coaches. I was very, very fortunate. So to finally be an Olympian along with them is really, really cool.
Another first-time Olympian is Roth's teammate, Becca Hamilton. The two have curled together since they were teenagers.
Yeah, once I was drug out on the ice, I didn't look back. I was down here every single day before school, after school, playing in multiple leagues a night. And I was hooked, so.
Becca isn't the only Hamilton heading to Pyeongchang. Her brother, Matt, is competing on the men's curling team. And together, Matt and Becca Hamilton are competing in the brand new Olympic event, mixed doubles curling.
About 4 years ago, they announced that it was going to be an Olympic sport, and that's when me and Becca kind of metaphorically stood back and looked at each other and were like, yeah, this is something we got to do, because the brother-sister thing, we're going to have an advantage as far as what we know about each other and how we play. So, yeah, it was kind of a no-brainer.
The Hamiltons have been getting a lot of attention outside of Madison. Here they are on NBC's The Tonight Show, starring Jimmy Fallon.
So it is my honor to introduce two of the best curlers in the world. Please give a warm Tonight Show welcome to U.S. Olympic curling team superstars and real-life siblings, Becca and Matt Hamilton, ladies and gentlemen.
And with the attention comes more money. Team USA's curlers have received corporate sponsorships, and they've even appeared in advertisements. This is huge for the athletes, since travel and equipment can be really expensive. Becca Hamilton works for Dick's Sporting Goods. Matt Hamilton tests home appliances for Spectrum Brands. The sponsorships also help make up for the fact that they're missing a month of work to go to the Olympics.
And then also all the time and effort we're putting into training, and if we're not at work, it helps, I guess, just get by on a day-to-day basis. Where a lot of curlers from different countries, this is their job, so they get a salary to curl, where we don't get that yet in the U.S. So
that would be just dreamy.
Then the Hamiltons, along with Nina Roth, could focus their time on curling and training the next generation of Olympians who come through the Madison Curling Club. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The opening ceremony is tomorrow, but competition is already underway. Here's a spoiler alert if you want to watch it later. Matt and Becca Hamilton won their first mixed doubles match earlier today, defeating Russian athletes 9-3, but later on they lost their second match to Canada 4-6.
To learn more about all of Wisconsin's Olympic athletes and to see how they're doing, you can go to WPR.org/Olympics.
And tomorrow on Central Time, a Wisconsin Olympic athlete gives us a behind-the-scenes look at Nordic combined skiing. That plus Food Friday coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.